So starting with finishing the definition of modular forms of level one, I left off last time, I told you what a weakly modular function is of weight k. It's a function f on, say, the upper half plane, and it transforms in a certain way under the action of SL2z. And I wanted to, I already defined that weakly modular function. But for a number of reasons, first to get your hands really on modular forms, but also just to give a definition, it's important to have a notion of what happens at the cusp that we've omitted, the extra element of what happens at infinity. So here's what you do. So we have a function f on the upper half plane. Here's the upper half plane. There's I, some real numbers here. And we'd like to understand the behavior of this function locally around infinity. So here's how you do that. Consider this vertical strip that goes through the nodes. That goes from 0 to 1. Then the function e to the 2 pi iz defines an isomorphism between this vertical strip and the open unit disk. If we include the boundaries in the closed unit disk, with the origin removed. So the function I'm using here is what I'll call q equals q of z, which is e to the 2 pi iz. And just to get a sense of what happens, let's figure out what this does to a grid. So for example, if you allow z to range over real numbers between 0 and 1, then e to the 2 pi iz ranges over numbers from, the closed unit disk, it ranges around the boundary. So this strip at the bottom, this horizontal line, maps to the boundary of that circle. Now if you go up a little bit, then the numbers that you're substituting in, they're in the form, x, z here is equal to x plus iy, where y is some small positive real number. So what happens if you substitute that in for z, you get e to the 2 pi I x plus iy, which is e to the minus 2 pi y times e to the 2 pi I x. So as x again varies from 0 to 1, this again runs through a circle, except now the radius of the circle is a little bit less than 1. So these horizontal lines map to circles over here. And vertical lines map to rays. For example, this vertical line on the left-hand side, that gives you the ray from the origin over to the point 1. And likewise, each of these other vertical lines maps to rays from the origin to some point on the boundary of the circle. Does anybody not have a copy of the notes? I feel like Chuck Durant.
Thanks.
So that's what the function q equals e to the 2 pi iz does. It defines a bijection between this strip and this disk, where I'll leave off this. So it's a strip with the right-hand side left off. Now, here's the neat thing. Any weakly modular function is invariant in a certain sense. I mean, it's not exactly invariant, but there's a transformation, which was f of az plus b equals cz plus d. That's equal to cz plus d to the minus k f of z. That's the condition that defines a modular form, a weakly modular function. And one particular element of SL2z that you can consider and apply this formula to is 1101. I'll call it t. So yesterday I proved something, namely that there's no modular functions of odd weight. And I proved that by considering the matrix minus 1, 0, 0, minus 1. I'm using this formula. Now today I'm going to observe something about modular functions using this particular matrix, a different element of SL2Z. So just substitute this into the formula, and it says that f of z plus 1 is equal to, well, on the bottom you just have 1 to the, it doesn't matter what k is, f of z. That is to say, a weakly modular function, any weakly modular function at all, the weight doesn't matter, this k, which is a parameter here, doesn't matter. Any weakly modular function is periodic of period 1. It's a function on this strip, a function here. If you restrict it to a function on this strip, you get all the information you need to define the function everywhere. It's completely determined by what it does here. So since we have this bijection between this strip and the unit disk, which I'll call just D, but since I removed the origin, I'll call it D prime, which is the disk minus the origin. Instead of considering f as a function on the upper half plane, let's consider another function on the disk, which is completely determined by little f, and completely determines little f, given f is a modular function. So just define a function capital F. Define capital F from the disk to the complex numbers. And notice I remove the origin. And F is really simple to define. F of, I'll call it Q. I'm thinking of the variable over here as being Q, since after all, the function's Q, so given a number here, I have Q of that number over here. F of Q is just little f of, well, maybe I should actually, yeah, I'm sorry. F of Q is little f using right about it. I'll just write f of, I guess, w, or yeah, f of w equals little f of q inverse of w. So given a number here, you can consider its inverse over here. Since we're doing q as a function from this disk, I mean from this vertical strip to the disk, it makes sense to there is an inverse function. And you just take the inverse and you compose it with f, and the result is our function capital F. And it's a function on the disk. Now the nice thing about this function is that the behavior of little f around infinity, which is way up here, is exactly mirrored by the behavior of the function capital F at the origin here. So it's like we've chosen, not like we've chosen a way of writing down a nice neighborhood of infinity, in some sense. So f at, or f near zero, is the same, literally the same as little f near infinity. So we have this function capital F. This function e to the 2 pi z is a nice holomorphic function. And capital F as a function on this disk is, minus the origin, is a holomorphic function. So here's what you do. Well, you say that F is neuromorphic on the disk if it has a, well, if it's just the same definition as before. If some power of the parameter here times F is holomorphic, holomorphic means that you have a power series expansion. So f is well-behaved or meromorphic on the disk if f has a power series expansion about the origin, possibly with negative powers. So f is meromorphic at zero if, I don't have much serious chalk problems, but f is meromorphic at zero if there's a power series, f of w equals sum, or m greater than or equal, I'll say for n greater than or equal to some integer m, a sub n w to the n. So here m is an integer, possibly negative. some. So F is meromorphic at zero if this is the case, if F has a power series expansion, possibly of negative terms. And little f is, you say that little f is meromorphic at infinity if capital F is meromorphic at zero. That's the right thing to do. So little f is meromorphic at infinity if capital F is meromorphic at zero. Also, really, it's perfectly okay to view the variable over here as q. I just didn't want to call it q in defining this. So we can view this power series as a power series in q. And this expansion, it's called the q expansion of little f. Because after all, if you, well, I'll leave this as w, but notice that f of q of z is equal to capital F of q of z. So a power series expansion for capital F about zero gives a representation of your function little f. It's a way of sort of writing down your function little f. I mean, in general, with a holomorphic function, you can choose some point and then consider a Taylor expansion about that point, and you get a representation for your function. And this is a kind of extreme case of that, because the point that you're considering is at infinity. But it's made completely concrete by simply choosing an isomorphism between this strip and the unit disk. Yes, please.
Is that q of z on both sides there?
Well, the way I've written it, here I notice this is f of this, so
the left-hand side just f of z?
It should just be f of z on the left, right?
Yes. The right-hand side is perfectly fine, left-hand side is not. Doesn't make any sense of this. Yes, so it should be f of z on the left-hand side. Thank you. Okay, good. So just some observations. First is that, let's just suppose that n is equal to zero. So capital F is a holomorphic function on the unit disk. Then it's a theorem from complex analysis that the power series expansion of your function converges to the function everywhere in that disk. So because the function is holomorphic everywhere. This is just like in, you know, like when you teach calculus, and you have a radius of convergence for a Taylor expansion. Here the radius of convergence is at least one. So if you have a holomorphic function everywhere here, and it has a Taylor expansion about zero, and it converges everywhere here. That means that our function little f is equal to this power series. It's given by this power series, and the series converges everywhere on the upper half plane. So it might be something you could wonder about. If you have a weakly modular function, then you have this notion of potentially having a q expansion about infinity. You might not have it, because maybe your function, a priori, maybe your function has some weird essential singularity at infinity. But assuming it doesn't, then you have a power series expansion like this. And from complex analysis, you know that the power series expansion converges everywhere on the unit disk. And consequently, the power series expansion for little f, the Fourier expansion, if you like, of little f, converges everywhere in the upper half plane. Okay, so finally I can define a modular function. A modular function is just a weakly modular function that is holomorphic at infinity. Holomorphic at infinity just means that this m is greater than or equal to zero. I'll write this down. A modular function. Alright, so there's actually, okay, and this spoke slightly. A modular function is a weakly modular function that is meromorphic at infinity, and the modular form is a weakly modular function that's holomorphic everywhere. Modular function that is neuromorphic affinity. So it's a function on the upper half plane. It's holomorphic on the upper half plane, except possibly at some discrete set of bound points. So this is neuromorphic. The upper half plane, and at infinity it behaves nicely in the sense that if you choose a bijection between, or consider this bijection between this strip and the disk, then the function that you get in a natural way from your function on the upper half plane behaves nicely at zero. So that's a modular function. It's the same as a weakly modular function, except you have a condition at infinity. The behavior is nice. And finally, a modular form for SL2Z. This is also for SL2Z, or on SL2Z. That's what people say more often. A modular form on SL2Z is a modular function that's holomorphic everywhere. H and at infinity. That's a modular form of level 1. So it's by no means obvious, again, that these things exist at all. I mean, why should there be any? It's a pretty hard thing to have happen, that you have a function that's holomorphic on the upper half plane. It behaves nicely under the action of SL2Z, and it's also holomorphic at infinity. So there are some obvious examples. For example, if k equals 0, then the transformation condition is just following. So let's consider k equal to 0, weight 0. It says that f of az plus b over cz plus d is equal to cz plus d to the k, which is, well, k is 0, so there's nothing there, is equal to f of z. And you have this condition for all A, B, C, D in SL2Z. So an example of a function that satisfies this is any constant function. So constant functions work. They're certainly holomorphic. At infinity, they also are equal to a constant, so they have a power series. So constant functions are weight zero modular forms. We saw on Monday that when k is odd, there aren't any examples at all, except for zero, the function zero. You could certainly ask, are there any other functions that satisfy this for k equal to zero that are not constant? What do you think? So you have to have a function that is holomorphic on the upper half plane, holomorphic at infinity, and it is invariant under the action of SL2Z. That is to say, it would define a holomorphic function on the quotient of the upper half plane by the action of SL2Z. And even the compactified quotient, because of this condition that the function is holomorphic at infinity. So what would that be? Well, if you had a weight zero modular form, and it wasn't constant, it would be a non-constant function on the Riemann sphere, a non-constant holomorphic function on the Riemann sphere. But Riemann sphere has genus zero, so there aren't any such functions. So in fact, the constants are the only ones, but already that required some non-trivial statement from complex analysis to see. It's definitely not a trivial fact that the only weight zero modular forms are the constants, but these are all of them.
And how about just weakly modular?
Oh, then there could be tons. So weakly modular, let's see, did I define Weekly, I defined weekly modular function, but I didn't define weekly modular form.
Right, no, it's just weekly modular function that they're under.
Okay, then there could be a lot, because if you take any two, now I haven't told you, believe me, there are lots and lots of modular forms of higher weight. So if the weight's bigger than zero, there are lots of examples. If the weight's bigger than, even in bigger than or equal to five, then there's always a modular form of that weight that's non-zero or non-constant. If you take two forms of the same weight and divide them, the result is a weakly modular function of weight zero. So you get really a huge number of weakly modular functions of weight zero. So it's really a very big set. But notice when you divide them, what happens is the zeros of the denominator contribute poles, and as a result, you get something that is not holomorphic in the upper half plane, and possibly not holomorphic at infinity if the poles happen to all be at infinity. So let me just record what I've said so far. Quick summary. First, I've defined modular forms. Here's the notation that is typically used for what I've defined. MKSL2Z. For each integer k, there's a complex vector space of functions that behave. I'll put the cz plus d to the minus k in here so I can point at it. They behave like this under the action of SL2z, and they're holomorphic on the upper half plane and holomorphic at infinity. So for each k, you have a set of functions like that, and it's not too hard to see it's closed under addition and scalar multiplication. So for each k, you have a complex vector space like this. Complex vector space. And when k is odd, so I'll write m sub an odd k, SL2z, then you get that this vector space is just a zero space. When k is 1, I'm sorry, when k is 0, that's the case I was pointing to over here, then you get the constants. When k is 2, well, that's an interesting story, but it turns out you get 0. When k is 4, you get a one-dimensional space spanned by a completely explicit function called, I'll call it E4. It's called the weight 4 Eisenstein series. And keep going.
M6 is dimension 2.
What?
M6 with dimension 2.
Actually, M6 also has dimension 1.
Oh, okay.
But M12 has dimension 2 or 3. 2. Yeah, M12 has. So the thing with M12 is you can take this form of weight 4, multiply it by a form of weight 6. You take this one and cube it. If you cube this, you get something of weight 12. If you take the form of weight 6 and cube it, you get something of weight 12, and those are totally different.
Square.
You square the one of weight 6, and you take those two, and they're linearly independent. So you have to wait a little bit. But N6 also has dimension 1. There's actually a simple formula for the dimension, and I'll talk about this in great detail next week. So there's a structure theorem that completely describes the modular forms of level 1. Actually, I'll tell it to you right now. You take the unique up to scalars E4, you take the unique up to scalars form of weight 6,
they're just,
or call it E6.
The E4 and E6 are just the coefficient in the elliptic curves, right?
Sure, yep, yeah. But for that you have to view modular forms as functions on elliptic curves with a differential. So it's a little, but yeah, that's all they are, up to scalars. So you take these two and they generate a polynomial algebra over the complex numbers. They're two complex functions. You take the ring they generate, and that's exactly the same thing as the modular forms of level 1. So it's a nice simple description actually. So I'll talk about that more next week. But I'll just write that right here. If you take the direct sum over k greater than or equal to, well, over all integers k, there's nothing when k is negative, by the way, of mk sl2z. This is an algebra under multiplication. It has a grading given by the weight, and it's just the same thing as C adjoin E4 and E6. You can take E4 and E6 to be any non-zero modular forms of weight 4 and 6. Nonetheless, there are a number of very interesting, difficult open problems about level 1 modular forms. So don't think that just because you have this, that the game is over. It's far from over. For example, when you start explicitly writing down these modular forms, here's an example element. Delta equals q product 1 minus q to the n to the 24. This is the Ramanujan delta function. Wait.
So is this weight 24 or weight 12?
Weight 12. In Sarah's book, it would be weight
24.
Well, I don't know, but it's definitely weight 12. There are a number of open problems about this one modular form. So it's easy to write down. You can compute lots of coefficients if you want. Here's an open problem. Compute the pth coefficient in time polynomial in the number of digits of p. Actually, it's not quite an open problem. Bass, Edixoven, and collaborators claim to have proved that it's possible, but they haven't written down their proof yet. I believe it's possible, too, for other reasons. Nobody's actually done it in practice, though. So just computing the coefficients in what's considered fast time is considered, well, is an interesting problem still. Another problem, if you look at the coefficients, they look like they're all non-zero. Are they? It's a conjecture that they're all non-zero, but it's not a theorem. It's a very difficult conjecture. You can even ask, is p divided tau of p? I didn't tell you tau is. Here we go. Actually, I'll just write this as sum tau of n q to the n, n equals 1 to infinity. All I'm doing here is naming the coefficients of this power series tau of n. This function tau of n, which gives the coefficients of this, it's called the Ramanujan tau function. And there was a conjecture Ramanujan made about the absolute value of tau p. He said it wasn't too big, namely that it's at most p to the 11 twelfths, 2 times. Is at most an absolute value 2 times p to the 11 twelfths. And turned out to be a pretty hard conjecture, and Levine proved it by proving the Weyl conjectures, and he actually proved much more than just this. But this proof got him a Fields Medal, so it was certainly considered impressive. So this is not an open problem. It's in fact true that the coefficients of this function, if you multiply them all, are small. But it's not obvious. Just the fact that this is a deep theorem should tell you, well, there's something going on with modular forms. Another thing is, if you take this function and invert it, and take its 24th root, then you get the generating function for the number of partitions of an integer. So understanding this function tells you about partitions of an integer. So it's related to combinatorics, or modular forms are related to combinatorics. But this is really what I'll talk about a lot next week. This is really important because it gives you a method to compute all the modular forms of a given weight. All you have to do is find all integers. This is very easy. A and B such that 4a plus 6b is equal to your weight, and you multiply together power series as appropriate. But things get really interesting because there's an algebra of Hecke operators that acts on each of these individual graded pieces, and computing them and understanding their properties is extremely subtle. So summary, The definition of a modular form, it's a holomorphic function on the upper half plane that's also holomorphic at infinity, and it behaves like this, which also means that the differential, in quotes, f of z dz to the power k over 2 is invariant under the action of SL2z. You can also define modular forms in a whole bunch of different ways as functions on elliptic curves equipped with the differential, or some power of the differential, as functions on lattices, as sections of certain sheaves, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All these other definitions require that you know a lot more geometry than I'm assuming. So most books and me start by giving this sort of analytic definition. Because this one's really nice because it doesn't require that much background. All you have to do is know what a holomorphic function is, really, in order to at least know what the definition says. Okay, so that's modular forms of level 1.
And did I forget to say anything? One other thing, cusp forms. A cusp form is simply a modular form that vanishes at infinity.
So you have the space MK SL2Z, and inside of it there's a subspace which is denoted SK SL2Z, and it's called the space of cusp forms. It's a set of F that are modular forms with one additional condition. So it's the F like this, such that F of infinity equals 0, where so what do I mean by f of infinity? Well, because f is a modular form, it has a power series expansion about infinity. That is, capital F has a power series expansion about 0. And f of infinity just means it's just the constant term of that power series expansion. Or you could think of it just as a limit as z goes to infinity along the i-axis of f of z. So this F, though, has a power series expansion, it's holomorphic, it goes from 0 to infinity, a n, q to the n, and this F of infinity, this is just a sub 0. So infinity under the map Q that I had drawn before gets sent to 0 in the disk, and if you have a power series expansion about 0, the constant term gives the value of the function at 0. And since infinity goes to 0, this is the right meaning of evaluating F of infinity. So this is a subset of MK SL2Z. It's in fact a subspace, because if you have two functions and they're both they both vanish at infinity, certainly their sum does. So we have a complex subspace of MK SL2Z. And it's called space of cusp forms. Weight k on SL2Z, or for SL2Z. And sometimes there's no space here, and sometimes there is a space here. I typically put a space here. You might think this should be a C, but it's an S because in German, the word for cusp form is Spitzenform, which starts with an S. And I think in French it's I don't want to pronounce French, but in French it's cuspidal, so it starts with a C. So English is more like French, but for this particular terminology, it's sort of fortunate we don't have to call them Spitzenforms in English. There are a number of terms in modular forms that are German, which is kind of good. But I don't know. Okay, so not anything against German, it doesn't look much like English, so it's confusing and scary. Or mathematical terminology. Okay, so this is a subspace of cusp forms. It turns out that this codimension is 1 in the case of SL2Z. And you can all see more about that next week, or depending on time, possibly on Friday. And these are really the most interesting forms, the cusp forms. One other I won't say more about that now, but I'll come back to it in a minute. All right, so that ends my discussion about modular forms level 1. Any questions? So again, I'm going to talk a little more about structure and how to compute them later on after telling you about modular forms in general. So modular forms at level 1 in some ways are a lot easier than general modular forms, not surprisingly. But the definition of general modular forms, there are a couple of new twists that you might not expect if you've just seen level 1 modular forms. Before I start talking about general modular forms, I'm going to stop and have a commercial break for modular forms. So I made a long list of applications of modular forms all over mathematics on page 14 of the notes. And I'm just going to very briefly tell you about these, and then we'll return to the precise definition of higher level modular forms. And I'll start that, though of course I won't finish due to lack of time. So a first very, very well-known application of modular forms was to the proof of Fermat's Last Theorem by Andrew Wiles and Richard Taylor. So in fact, I first heard about modular forms when I was reading some notes that Alan Adler had written about the proof of Fermat's Last Theorem. So he had this long thing that he wrote and started talking about modular forms in there, and so I first heard about them in that context. If you don't know the outline of the proof, it's in very, very broad steps. Maybe I should put very, 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 very broad steps. It's like this. So you take a counterexample, a purported counterexample to Fermat's Last Theorem. You can reduce the prime case. So the thing says there are no positive integers x, y, and z, and prime odd primes p. Such that x to the p plus y to the p plus z to the p, and just because I want to write down an elliptic curve in a minute, I'll rename x, y, and z to a, b, and c. You can assume that a, b, and c are coprime, otherwise you can divide out the common factor. So you write down the elliptic curve, y squared equals x, x minus a to the p, x plus b to the p, which is the so-called, well, not really so-called, but phi curve, or Hilbert curve, depending on whether you're German or French. And it's an elliptic curve. You can compute its various invariants of this curve. In general, an elliptic curve is some curve given by an equation y squared equals a cubic, where the cubic is has distinct roots. So this curve, you can compute its discriminant and its conductor, and it has a special property called semi-stable, which means that the conductor is square-free. The conductor is, I think it's the same as the product of the primes that divide a, b, and c in this case. So you can compute this conductor, and you can also compute just other things like the discriminant and so on. The discriminant turns out to be a perfect Keith power. So if you look at a result that Ribbit proved, then you find that this combination of events implies that the modular form attached to this elliptic curve is congruent to a modular form of level 2. And I haven't told you what that means, but there aren't any that could possibly, of course, well, there are no cusp level modular forms of level 2. So you find that this curve couldn't have existed in the first place, and hence Fermat's Last Theorem has to be true. There wasn't a counterexample. Now, I skipped over very quickly what the modular form is attached to an elliptic curve, and I'll come back to that later as an example of a modular form that is not of level 1. So since I haven't defined modular forms that aren't of level 1, I can't tell you how to attach a modular form to an elliptic curve. But you given a counterexample to Fermat, you write down an elliptic curve. Given an elliptic curve, any elliptic curve at all, you can write down a power series, some a and q to the n. If you're extraordinarily clever, you can prove that that power series is a modular form. By extraordinarily clever, I mean you're Ray Conrad, Diamond, Taylor, and Wiles. And knowing that it's a modular form allows you to apply a theorem of Ribbit, which tells you that it doesn't exist. That doesn't exist. And hence you conclude that this elliptic curve doesn't exist, hence this equation has no non-trivial solutions. There aren't any examples like this. And this method of, I guess, proving there are no solutions to certain Diophantine equations has been
has evolved over the years. This was done in the early 90s. For example, Yiman Chen at Simon Fraser University, he's one of the world experts on using this method to prove that certain Diophantine equations don't have any solutions when they shouldn't. So, one of the current experts is our neighbor, Yiman Chen. Your neighbor is kind of. Okay, so that's one example of an application of modular forms, proving that certain Diophantine equations don't have any solutions. Very famous one, since this is an
extraordinarily hard problem.
By the way, what Wiles did, I mean, really, Wiles' contribution was to prove that this formal Q expansion that you write down associated to an elliptic curve are actually these numbers I got by counting points on the elliptic curve over finite fields. His contribution was to prove that this is a modular form. And that is incredibly useful for computations with elliptic curves. It really extends what you can do algorithmically with elliptic curves efficiently, especially for computations related to the Bergson-Swain and Dirac conjecture. So his work, not only did it prove Fermat, but it also just vastly extended what you could do algorithmically with elliptic curves, what you could compute about them. Another problem that is, again, like an old problem in number theory, but this one's 1,000 years old, is the congruent number problem. So it's the following problem. Take a right triangle with rational side lengths. For example, 3, 4, 5. That's a famous one everybody learns about in elementary school or junior high or whatever. It has an area. In that case, the area is, what is the area? 3, 4, 5, 1 half times the base times 6. It has area 6. Right? And there are lots of other examples. You can enumerate them. You can enumerate every single one, right? Just by drawing a circle and then drawing a line that goes through a point and parameterizing by the slope. So the question is, which integers appear as the area of a right triangle with rational side lengths? Seems like a reasonably harmless question. It was asked over 1,000 years ago, and it is unknown even today which integers occur. Unknown in the following sense. Given an algorithm that takes its input an integer and outputs either yes, that integer is the area of a right triangle with rational side lengths, or no, it's not. And by an algorithm, I mean something you could reasonably program into a computer that would run in a finite amount of time and give you either yes or no answer. There's a precise definition of algorithm, and I'm certainly not giving it. But that is even today an open problem. But it's almost a solved problem. There's a specific modular form that you can write down, and if you assume that the Bergson-Swearington-Dirac conjecture is true, I haven't told you what that conjecture is, but it's the most important conjecture about elliptic curves that is, I'll just stop with that sentence. It's the most important conjecture about elliptic curves right now. There's a modular form, and you can write it down, and assuming that conjecture, the nth coefficient of that modular form is non-zero if and only if n is not a congruent number. So it's just a simple thing. You just compute as many coefficients of this weight 3 Hausdorff modular form as you want, and you just look at the nth coefficient, it tells you whether or not n is a congruent number. So it'd be really nice if that were a theorem. It's not a theorem, it's just a conjecture. You do know if, so sorry, and it's if and only if. Actually, one direction is a theorem. If the coefficient's non-zero, then it's definitely the case that the number n is not a congruent number. The other direction, though, if the coefficient is zero, then you don't know that n is a congruent number. It may be, maybe it isn't. And it turns out that the reason it's so hard to deal with the case when the coefficient is zero is because there you expect a certain elliptic curve to have infinitely many rational points. And it's very hard to prove or to construct rational points on objects in number 3. You can often prove there aren't any, but to construct them is hard. So another example of an application of modular forms is to an almost complete solution of the congruent number problem, modulo the Bergson-Swearington-Dirac conjecture. There's a third example, which I can hardly say anything about, unfortunately, but there's something called topological modular forms that probably Chuck knows more than me about, because actually almost anybody does, unfortunately. I looked online, there are a lot of papers that seem to use topological modular forms to prove all kinds of things, and I've seen talks about them, so they seem to be revolutionizing something, and they're certainly motivated by modular forms. Maybe you could say something, since you're shaking your head.
Yes. No, I was nodding, actually.
Yeah,
at some point, if there's no student project in the subject, I'm more than happy.
Yeah, this would be a great project, though. There's lots of nice expository stuff about it, and I don't know anything about it. Another application, so I just saw a couple of talks about this in San Diego by Kristen Lauder and Ale Gorin. I heard about this a long time ago from Peter Sarnak, but using modular forms, you can construct graphs that they're expander graphs. They are almost optimal relative to some property of the eigenvalues of their adjacency matrix. But they're extremely useful for constructing networks in computer networks, any sort of communications network. So people think a lot about modular forms related algorithms for computing these. So there are applications of modular forms to constructing communications networks. And it has actually been studied a lot in the last 10 years, I think. Another application is to point counting on elliptic curves. Just sort of the general theory of modular forms is all over the place there. There's a beautiful article of Noam Elke's in a volume devoted to Oliver Atkin, and it's mostly about methods for counting points on elliptic curves over finite fields, and it has all kinds of remarks about how modular forms play a role. And this is absolutely essential. There's no way you could convince your boss to let you use an elliptic curve cryptosystem if it wasn't for being able to count the number of points on an elliptic curve over a finite field. And these cryptosystems are vastly superior to RSA. Neil Kollwitz would like to hear me say that because he's one of the co-inventors of elliptic curve cryptography. But basically, you get something that's probably much harder to crack than RSA, and the key sizes are much smaller. Plus, you have to know about elliptic curves to understand them at all. So maybe a few people won't understand them and try to break them. But that's not really the point. It's that they have better properties from a theoretical point of view. The Bertrand-Swinnerton-Dyer conjecture. Maybe I'll just tell you what it is. And I'll start fresh next time with modular forms of higher level. So the Bertrand-Swinnerton-Dyer conjecture says if you have an elliptic curve, I'll talk about it in the case that Bertrand-Swinnerton-Dyer first discussed, though you can generalize this left and right in all kinds of other directions besides left and right. But if you have an elliptic curve over Q, then you can you can consider two things. One is the Mortal Vague group of the elliptic curve. You take all the rational solutions to the curve plus a point at infinity, you get an abelian group. And it's a finitely generated abelian group. So it's isomorphic to Z to the R plus some finite torsion group. On the other hand, you can consider the product over all primes P of 1 over 1 minus 8. I'll just say 8 in a second. 1 minus 8P times P to the minus S plus P to the 1 minus 2S. And so then I'll say P, that's a prime of Fourier reduction. So that just means that this equation has distinct roots modulo P, and let's just say that P is greater than or equal to 5 for safety. This is a function called the L function of the elliptic curve. It's, as I've given it, it's only defined on a right half plane. For a real part of S greater than or equal to 3 halves, this product converges, and you get a nice holomorphic function. But because every elliptic curve is modular, a old theorem of Hecke tells you that this has an analytic continuation to the whole complex plane. It just exploits some symmetry that comes from the modularity. It's not too hard to prove once you know modularity. And so it makes sense to consider this function at 1. And the Bertrand-Swinnerton-Dyer conjecture says that this R right here is equal to the order of vanishing at S equal to 1 of LES. So that's what it says. That's the Bertrand-Swinnerton-Dyer conjecture.
So first, in order to even make sense of this conjecture, we need modular forms right now, at least in order to be sure that this really makes sense at s equal to 1. Without modular forms, you wouldn't even know that this function is defined at s equal to 1. So that's one way in which modular forms are relevant to the conjecture. Also, there are three big theorems about the conjecture due to Kato, Kali-Vagan, and Gross-Zagier. Those are really the three big theorems. Every single one of them uses modularity of elliptic curves and modular forms in some sort of crucial role. So modular forms are really, really important to understand this conjecture. So I think I'll stop now, and I'll pick up next time with, I'll pick up next time with the definition of modular forms of level n, and then at the end next time I'll finish talking about these other applications of modular forms to Serre's conjecture and to lattices. Okay, so if you don't have a copy of the notes, make sure to get one.
Hold on,
do
you have a homework?
What? Yes, the homework which I handed out as promised on Wednesday is given at the end of the notes. There are 8 problems. And every single problem here there are no stupid problems here, I think, in the sense that if you do these, I made all these problems while writing the text directly so that you would understand the text better. So they're not just stupid contrived problems. The problem is that if you do them, you'll understand what you're hearing from me and reading better than if you don't. So I encourage you to do them, or if you're not going to do them and write them out, just look at them and do them in your head, sort of, or see how you would do them if you're not taking the class for credit.
If anyone wants to do that in that project, topological modular forms, I'm more than happy to.
We should just give it a try.
Otherwise, I'll just give a talk.
We should give like a 15 or 20 minute talk in here. I think that would be really fun.
Although, I probably have to define here.
I'm sure there'll be a day when I'm gone, and you can substitute for me.
If I'm in town, we can arrange it.
Yeah.